You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We know that ISIL is organised and directed from northern Syria. And it is for all members to consider carefully how best to tackle ISIL, an evil caliphate that does not respect state boundaries.
UK Defence Secretary Michael Fallon suggests that the Royal Air Force extend its contribution to the campaign against Islamic State to targets inside Syria. My guests Daniela Peled and Shashank Joshi will discuss the reasons why and if it would make much difference. We'll also ask if the UN's concern about the worsening humanitarian situation in Yemen will either persuade the combatants to cease their fire or the world to help. We'll do what little we can to help our Greek listeners figure out what they're voting on this Sunday. And BP continues to count the cost of the 2010 Deepwater Horizon disaster. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London right now. And welcome to the programme. My guests today are Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and contributor to Haaretz, among others, and Shashank Joshi, senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both. Now, first of all, since the debatably effective air campaign against Islamic State began a little over a year ago, the coalition conducting it has operated a two-tier strategy. Some contributors are only striking targets inside Iraq with the assent of Iraqi authorities. Others are also striking Islamic State State's heartland in Syria without the permission of Damascus, although it's hard to imagine Bashar al-Assad is too upset about it. In the wake of the IS-inspired murder of up to 30 British tourists in Tunisia, UK Defence Secretary Michael Fallon has today suggested that it is time the Royal Air Force joined operations on both sides of the border. Shashank Joshi, first of all, is there going to be anything left for them worth blowing up?
Well, not an awful lot. I mean, there's a lot, but it's just buried inside cities and very hard to get. If you look at the coalition currently bombing Syria, not the UK, as you say, they've mostly been bombing up in the Kurdish areas in the north. They've been hitting, defending places like Kobani. They've been helping Kurds retake places like Tel Abyad. There's a couple of strikes, pinpricks here and there in Raqqa, the IS headquarters and so on. But really, all the action is in Iraq. I looked at the statistics and pretty much every month other than two since the war began last year, there have been more strikes in Iraq than in Syria. So it's not a question of whether there's stuff to blow up. There's, you know, tank after tank. If you look at what the Defense Department's releasing, you know, gun emplacement, a bunker here, a building there. The issue is the really valuable stuff is taking and seizing cities held by ISIS. And right now in Syria, there's no one on the ground who can do that under the cover of bombs.
A follow-up thought on that. Is the Royal Air Force able to contribute anything to the coalition it does not already have access to?
I don't think it can. It's doing a pretty good job in Iraq, I'd say. It's contributing lots of intelligence and surveillance aircraft to find these targets. The problem isn't a want of bombs or a want of aircraft to drop them. It's finding the targets in the first place, and that requires drones, it requires surveillance aircraft. Britain has those in Iraq. If it had to send those to Syria as well, I think it would be diluting its presence to quite a great degree and replicating what the US is mostly doing up in Syria anyway.
Daniela, does this statement strike you as having something of the cosmetic gesture about it from Michael Fallon? Obviously, after a dreadful event like the murder of it, roughly, we think, we're still not sure of the final numbers, 30 British tourists in Tunisia, the UK government is probably feels obliged to make some sort of gesture. Is this just the thing they can do?
Well, it's hard to tell. I think he's testing the waters for a potential change of strategy. I mean, David Cameron was burnt quite badly in August, I think it was, in 2013, when he wanted
to take
action. And as we all know, Ed Miliband scotched that completely. Now, if they're going to change their approach to this, I don't think it's because somehow Islamic State has become a danger, direct danger to British citizens, because however many British citizens were killed in Tunisia, the stakes are much higher and the problem is much wider. I agree with Shashank. You know, Iraq seems to be the place where all the action is happening. And there is, at least in theory, a framework for liberating IS-held territory and then, you know, putting it into the hands of a government that is theoretically at least our ally and exists. I'm not quite sure in Syria, when partly the problem of Islamic State came because there was a vacuum there. And who exactly are we liberating Islamic State-held territory from in Syria to hand it over to? You know, if this is a move that just helps, this is just... almost blatantly helps Assad.
I think that's the nub of it, right? It's who are they liberating this for? Well, of course, the moderate rebels who were supposedly training up to 5,000 a month with create a rebel army. How many are actually enrolled in the Defense Department, the Pentagon's program at this point? Under 100. Because rebels don't like being told they should fight ISIL when they really want to fight Assad. And here's the problem for Fallon. He wants to say, we should do something, we should do more, we should bomb Syria. But if he actually says, and that requires training many more rebels, expanding the area of operations, supporting these rebels in their offensives against places like Raqqa, Parliament would suddenly say, ooh, we're not so sure about this now.
Daniel, you're quite right on that earlier point that David Cameron lost a parliamentary vote on airstrikes in Syria in 2013. That was, of course, before he had a majority to call his own in Parliament, which he does now have. He also has an opposition Labour Party saying today it will look, I quote, very, very seriously at any such proposals, which suggests they're possibly slightly more amenable than they were when led by Ed Miliband. Are we being prepared, do you think, at any level for an eventual more dramatic escalation against Islamic State? Because I was struck as well, I have to say, that the militarization of the homecoming of the tourists, I thought, was interesting as well. I mean, it made a certain amount of logistical sense that they should send the Air Force to go and collect them because that's the fastest way to do it. But to have civilians taken off the plane with full honor guards, et cetera, struck me as unusual.
You mean, are we being prepared to send ground troops in?
Something of that sort, yeah.
Look, there's a limit that can be done practically from the air. And you need people on the ground to call in airstrikes if you're going to really take very, very serious action. To me, and I'm not a military specialist, but to me it does make more sense to focus on Iraq first, because really the best anyone is hoping for, I think if they're honest, is containment when it comes to Islamic State right now. That seems the best way to contain it in Iraq. The idea, the concept of sending ground troops to Syria is kind of outlandish at the moment, I would say.
What do you think, Shashank? Is some sort of, or is it possible, I'll ask the same question from the other way around, is it possible to imagine that at some point, not imminently, but at some point in the next few years, a fairly meaningful military confrontation with Islamic State is not inevitable?
There's only one circumstance I can see in which there's British, or for that matter, American troops sitting inside cities in Iraq or Syria, and it will probably be Iraq rather than Syria, and that's if IS itself organises a major mass casualty attack on Western soil, not just inspired.
Tunisia actually, doesn't count?
I don't think so, and I think in terms of salience, in terms of political impact, it has to be in a European city, it has to be organised and directed by IS, not just by a single crazed gunman or group of gunmen. In other words, not just Charlie Hebdo-like attack. That, I think, could prompt a reassessment of political objectives in a way that would force the Labour Party to support the government. But even then, we would not be looking at a long occupation. And I think the government would be doing it merely to do something rather than as a serious effort to somehow rescue and put back together these broken countries.
I'm going to ask you both in turn what is possibly a silly question, because while mass casualty attacks on Westerners do tend to get all the press, day in, day out, the overwhelming majority of Islamic State victims are Arabs and they are Muslims. So my self-evidently silly question possibly is, why isn't the Arab League dealing with this, Daniela?
Well, I think it would be quite difficult for the Arab League to have a cohesive and consistent foreign policy and to act as one. You could ask the Gulf states to get involved militarily, which they have been historically, and I think we're going to talk about Yemen.
We are, very shortly.
A little later on. So saying, well, this is right, okay, we need the Arab League to come in and sort this out is not feasible anyway. There's too many conflicting interests there. I think we can recruit support militarily. I think there's only the Gulf state, Saudi Arabia, who were any serious military muscle.
Well, Turkey has a lot of military muscle. It's just that it has a very different view of the crisis and sees the problem here as being Kurds accumulating support on its southern flank rather than ISIS. I think there's an even more basic element to this, which is Iran. Iran looms over their threat perception. Okay, a mosque is blown up in Kuwait City. Okay, a mosque blows up in the eastern province. Ultimately, what really concentrates their minds is Iranian power rising throughout the region. And what they don't want is a total focus on eliminating ISIL, only to see they've handed over Iraq and Syria to Iran on a platter. That's why they're not happy with the current strategy. And I think that will continue until there is some really, really serious act of destabilization, probably like somewhere in Riyadh. Maybe that would prompt, again, a more serious gesture on their part.
But just a final thought on this, I guess, Shashank, what is stopping the Arab League from perceiving what is surely they can regard as a common threat?
Well, first of all, they are bombing Syria, right? They're pretty heavily involved.
Some
of them are, and to a greater or lesser extent. I think, first of all, they're distracted by Yemen, which is a far bigger Saudi concern at this point. They look at the rise of the Houthis, I think, in parallel terms with ISIS. They don't see this in the dramatic terms that we do. And I think, second of all, really, you cannot underestimate how much they feel ISIL, whilst problematic and dangerous and deviant, is at the end of the day, in part, a outgrowth and reflection of legitimate sectarian grievances by Iraq's disenfranchised and downtrodden Sunnis at the hands of a Shia and Iran-backed government. And therefore, they still view this in those sectarian geostrategic terms. We can't change their mind just by saying again and again, ISIL is dangerous. They understand that. They just think Iran is dangerous too.
Okay, well, let's look now at Yemen, which you mentioned there. It is, of course, another battlefield on which Islamic State are at least tangentially involved. The United Nations has this week declared Yemen a level 3 humanitarian emergency. And to put that in perspective, other countries presently distinguished by that distinction are Iraq, Syria and South Sudan. Level 3 status theoretically ramps up availability of staff and funding, but it, of course, does very little to stop the fighting long enough to allow those hastily white-painted transport planes to land. Daniela, is it, given the situation in Yemen, or I should footnote that, given what we understand of the situation in Yemen, because reporting from there is very, very thin on the ground because it is so horrifically dangerous, is this declaration by the UN likely to make any practical difference to anybody in Yemen?
I think it's unlikely, because one of the one thing that will happen, I think, is that Iran is going to exploit it massively for propaganda purposes, because this is largely due to the blockade, the sort of de facto blockade for the last 3 months on Yemen. It's not a pure humanitarian crisis by any stretch of the imagination. It's a result of conflict. As you said, getting aid into the country is incredibly different. I think around 80% of the population is reliant on aid right now. This is only getting worse. I mean, the reason it's been upgraded to a level 3 is that it's critical. It's that the situation is moving and developing, deteriorating very fast indeed. So it will raise the potential, the possibility of resources, of raising money, of raising funds, and directing aid efforts there. But practically making a difference on the ground is quite another story.
The numbers are indeed horrific. The UN is saying 21.1 million people need aid, 13 million are short of food, 9.4 million are running out of water. There's risk of famine and disease. There's already a dengue fever outbreak reported. Benefit records have been made over less. Why isn't this a bigger story?
Well, it's a very good question. It just hasn't been, in the way that South Sudan is not exactly an enormous story in the Western media,
yeah,
as well. You know, even Iraq at the height of the sectarian war, I think your bombings had to have triple figure casualty figures.
There's
to
conflict
really
fatigue,
feature,
isn't there, in these things?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I think it's been easy to explain, oh, this is a war between the Saudi Arabia and Iran. It's a proxy war, and the Yemenis aren't really feature. And that's been a sort of very black and white reporting, as well as it's difficult to be there. And it lacks the glamour and the easy access of reporting that other conflicts. I don't think. I mean, Israel Palestine gets an enormous amount of play, and it's really one of the least interesting, maybe, and one of the with the lowest casualty figures.
You know what's funny is that I was initially thinking, well, maybe it affects us less. This is one reason. But actually, if you spoke to any counter-terrorist official before last year, you know, 2013. What's the biggest terrorism threat on your radar? They would have said, without a shadow of doubt, it's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, the Yemeni branch. And that network is still there, still very dangerous. It seized new territory, exploited the violence. So even on strategic grounds, there's something puzzling and disturbing about our failure. Well, I think it's a very narrow bandwidth. We have space for one big war at a time. But right now, we're all focused on the Levant. And what we're missing is Yemen on the one hand, and of course, Libya on the other hand. But I can assure you, the minute that there's an attempted bomb on a plane by AQAP, this will be right back up in the headlines.
I just wonder if also a factor in it in its being overlooked is the exceeding difficulty there is in attempting to summon up any optimism about it at all. We had the unedifying spectacle last month of peace talks in Geneva, which actually ended up needing peace talks of their own when that descended into a punch-up.
But if that were the metric for press coverage, the Israel-Palestine conflict would be just... Page 94, yes. Column 18.
Well, so. Yeah, you make a fair point. But sticking with the peace talks that weren't, are we still at the point with this conflict where, tragic and arguably ridiculous though it is, peace is not actually in the interest of any of the parties to it?
Well,
apart from actually, you know, the people just trying to live their lives in Yemen.
I think this, within Saudi Arabia, they will have to decide whether the reputational hit they are taking now and will take if once this emergency continues is worth it. Because I think they've achieved a lot of their objectives. They've destroyed some of the Scud missiles, stockpiles. They've kind of frozen the conflict. They've ensured the Houthis haven't taken new land. And they've put a lot of pressure on the Houthis to at least talk. They always knew they would have to negotiate. They wouldn't bomb the Houthis out of existence. So I wonder if we are approaching the point soon in which Saudi Arabia will decide, actually, it is worth the discussion, it's worth compromising. I don't think that they want this to be an entirely open-ended campaign. I think they really have other pressing issues to their west as well.
Such reports as there are out of Sana'a said today that 8 people seem to have been killed by renewed Saudi airstrikes in the Yemeni capital. Daniela, do you think the Saudis appear to have a long-term plan at this point?
They can't really have a long-term plan. I mean,
because the idea that President Hadi is returning seems somewhat fanciful at this point.
It gets more and more fanciful, but you know, it is a competition, increasingly a competition between them and Iran. Iran has very little to lose as this carries on, and the Saudis have much more to lose. And I'm sure one of the responses to the upgrading of the UN emergency level will be Iran sends some shipments of aid in, they're turned away.
I want to say I agree entirely Iran will exploit this. I really don't think it's in Iran's power to force a conclusion, though. I mean, Iranian support to the Houthis is not enormous, certainly not decisive, and Iran could decide tomorrow to shut off all aid to the Houthis. I don't think that would be sufficient to change the Houthi calculus. This is really more about Saudi Arabia and the Houthis, and less, in a concrete sense, about Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Peled and Shashank Joshi. Coming up next, Greece and the EU impersonate the closing scene of Reservoir Dogs again, and BP gets the bill for Deepwater Horizon.
As Monocle's editors and correspondents dart from city to city, they get to know the best places to rest their heads, stretch their limbs after a long flight, and kick back with a contact in a hard-to-find cocktail bar. All this information is now available in a new collection of books, Monocle's travel guide series published by Gestalten. Up first, London.
This place won't ever beg for your adoration. It's just not that kind of town. But if you stick around long enough and occasionally give it your undivided attention, the city will eventually reveal what all the fuss is about. Trust us, it's worth the wait.
To celebrate the publication of our London guide, Monocle Films has produced a cinematic portrait of the city, from wild parks and lofty gardens to culinary discoveries and the best music venues. Our film journeys to our favourite places in the city we call home. London, premiering now in the film section at monocle.com.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Daniela Pellad and Shashank Joshi. On Sunday, the people of Greece will vote in a referendum on their economic future and arguably the economic future of the rest of Europe. This would be a less terrifying prospect were it not for the fact that the question they will be answering reads like one of those ones designed to confuse you into continuing to subscribe to Adobe Flash Player updates. It reads in full: should the proposal, which was submitted by the European Commission, the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund at the Eurogroup of June 25th, 2015, which consists of two parts that together consist of their comprehensive proposal, be accepted. The first document is entitled Reforms for the Completion of the Current Programme and Beyond, and the second is Preliminary Debt Sustainability Analysis. All Greek to me, etc. Does anyone want to have a whack at translating that?
It's a yes or no question.
I'm not sure which is yes and which is no, though. Does anyone, Shashank, first of all, some suggestion that they're deliberately trying to confuse the electorate into, I think, what the government wants is a no vote. I'm still wondering if the government actually understands the question. Are they being deliberately obtuse here? That's not a Pythagoras joke.
I think they...
clutching our foreheads.
We can all go home
studio.
Now. Yeah, no, I think that there's an element where they may be trying to shape the outcome, but really this is just an incredibly complex economic question. You know, it's difficult to think of a very simple way to frame this. They can't just write, do you want to agree with what the Europeans say or not? Because I mean, they would miss out on a number of sort of nuances that they have to convey. I think at this point, the purpose of the referendum is less about securing some clear mandate from the Greek publics. It's much more about strengthening their hand in negotiations with the Troika and with the Commission and the ECB. And it really, it's just the fact that they can go back and say, you know, our negotiating position is legitimated by this.
Daniela, does it matter, do you think, for the purposes that Shashank is outlining, at least, that almost nobody voting on Sunday will have actually read, much less understood, either of those two documents?
No, I mean, I don't think so. Of course, they won't have done. I think the government wants a no vote for it to strengthen their negotiating hand, but a yes vote could very well spell the end of the government. Although, you know,
well, Varoufakis, the finance minister, says he'll resign if there's a yes vote, and you know it's very difficult to see how they would survive even with a no vote. Though, you know, it's still very difficult to see how they could. How long they could limp on if Europe?
Oh, I don't know. It's a question of chutzpah, really. And I think if they could say, "Well, all right, we're going to push forward with the will of the Greek people," but I think it's either the survival of the party or the survival of the government. I think they're mutually exclusive.
Shashank, what have you made of that? There's been increasing downright undiplomatic tetchiness from Germany in particular in the last 24 to 48 hours, just now outright accusing the Greek government of lying to its own people. Is that fair?
I think German anger is understandable because they were blindsided by the very fact of the referendum. And, you know, what angers them particularly is the idea that even if the Greek people vote yes, they would then subsequently have to negotiate the implementation with a government that has, you know, that has earlier rejected these terms, and they don't trust the government to actually implement this in an honest and open way. I think they just don't trust a word that the Greek government says, and they just want to deal with someone who is more straightforward and honest. I think it's all broken down, and in some ways what Greece needs is a fresh start with a fresh set of figures who can negotiate honestly with Merkel and all.
Daniela, is there anything at this point keeping Greece either in the European Union or indeed in the, especially in the euro, other than the political vanity of EU grandees who are determined that the project must not be seen to fail?
It's not just political vanity. I mean, it'd be a disaster economically. It would be
As opposed to what we have.
Well, you know, things disasters can always get more disastrous, I think. I don't think it's just vanity, and I don't think the European project is just a question of vanity. I can see, even now, I can see all kinds of positive elements to it. It would be such an enormous blow to the European project, which is ongoing and in development. It would be an enormous and unimaginable blow to Greece as well. I mean, it would make Argentina 10 years ago seem... and that's basically what they can expect, you know. And that was, I think, our memories have faded about how devastating that was for the people, you know.
I think one of the issues with the bitterness of language and the legacy of this corrosive, poisonous legacy we'll be left by this week and in the previous weeks is that the European Union still has to talk about a number of other very important issues that are not to do with Greece. Military action against smuggling boats in Libya, a new round of sanctions on Russia in implementing the Minsk II Accords, a new round of sanctions on Iran. When you have this incredibly embittered country in there, well, even if it stays in the Eurozone and in the EU, that's going to poison some very, very difficult discussions we will have to have. That is just not what Europe needed right now. And I think, you know, Putin will be looking at this, rubbing his hands with glee.
Well, finally tonight, we should look to the United States. And very shortly after BP's Deepwater Horizon rig in the Gulf of Mexico exploded on April 20th, 2010, it was clear that when the bill finally came, it would be a big one. 11 people were killed, and the subsequent oil spill was the largest ever recorded. BP had already pleaded guilty to criminal charges and paid $4.5 billion in fines. And today they appear on the verge of settling with the US federal government and several Gulf states for another $18.7 billion. BP reckons that the total final amount they're on the hook for over Deepwater Horizon, $40 billion, which is more or less the GDP of Serbia. It's very nearly enough to bail Greece out, in fact. They're obviously not the most sympathetic of defendants, but I'll just ask you each. Daniela, is this, at what point do these numbers start getting meaningless?
I think they've already got meaningless, really.
I mean, obviously not to BP or having to write the check, but
yeah, I think they'll survive. I think they'll survive somehow. But it's because it's not just about compensating damage done. There also has to be compensation, you know, which has to have an emotional effect, you know, that people can continue to see that BP has got this socially conscious side. It was willing to make reparations and not just patch up the road after it's dug it, but also, you know, plant some flowers.
Shashank, is it just about BP trying to buy back their reputation? Do you get the sense that once people, you know, once the world turned, that its brand was enduringly damaged?
Well, I think it's also the case that there was a court proceeding and that it wasn't just up to them to give out of the goodness of their heart and an offer they deemed just and appropriate. It was a negotiation, and at the end of it was a court case and legal proceedings if the other side, the US government, wasn't happy with this. So I think that, yes, they're trying to salvage their reputation and they've done a great deal for that, but they're also potentially would have been struck with enormous court-ordered costs in any case outside of a settlement. I don't think this was entirely, you know, this was not an act of goodwill. This was an act of sort of legal compromise in the hope of avoiding something even worse.
Again, not wishing to sound like I'm advocating for BP over here, but do we think they'd have come down as hard on a US-owned firm, Daniela?
Why would they?
Well, I don't know. They sort of seemed to enjoy wailing on the big bad Brits at the time, which, obviously speaking, is an Australian.
It was always, you know, British Petroleum, and the Brits were furious. That's not our name. We haven't been called that for years. And Obama very conspicuously insisting this was a British-owned company.
Well, yes.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Shashank and Daniela, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tamor Haveda-Williams. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Daniel Giacopelli is here with Monocle's International Playlist. Andrew Tuck follows at 1900 hours with The Urbanist. At 2200, I'm back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time, for this edition. It's goodbye. Thanks for listening.